Welcome back. In my last lecture, I talked about archaeological work on this really very important site of Çatalhöyük in Anatolia in south-central Turkey, and about the ways in which archaeologists have interpreted that site through time. There's a variety of different issues that are raised by the site of Çatalhöyük for archaeologists, not merely those working there, but for archaeologists more generally. Here we have what appears to be the largest human settlement in the world in terms of population at this time period. We have to wonder how it was that people were beginning to learn how to live in communities of this size. There are some features of this site that are difficult for us to really explain or to understand. Here we have a large community that appears to have no public spaces, no public architecture. A large community where it seems almost as if people are constructing environments, constructing built environments, houses that are culturally and ritually charged, constructing these built environments almost to domesticate themselves at the same time as they are domesticating plants and animals, domesticating themselves to live and survive in groups of not merely tens or hundreds of people, but many thousands of people. So the one major issue then for researchers involves interpreting social systems, as at Çatalhöyük, that are very different than any that we modern people have direct experience of. Archaeologists know that the earliest civilizations in different parts of the world must have developed out of less centralized and less hierarchical political and social units. This is inevitable. The question then becomes, what did those societies ancestral to the first states look like, and how did this process of development of early states actually happen? This raises questions about the evolution of societies more generally. One absolutely vital question: are there single or multiple evolutionary trajectories along which states can develop? That is, should we accept that all states will originate and develop in more or less the same way? Or may we expect that each case is going to be quite different? Secondly, are there recent societies or modern societies that we can study ethnographically or historically to get a better idea of how this archaeological issue of state formation in ancient times actually worked? Now, I just note that when I speak about ethnographic research, I mean research by anthropologists on modern populations in different parts of the world. Historical research, using historical sources to look at the characteristics of recent, and when archaeologists say recent, I mean perhaps over the last few hundred years, to look at recent human societies. And then using these ethnographic data, historical data, to inform archaeology, to inform the interpretations of those of us who dig things up. Ideally, do we have recent cases of state formation that we can compare to ancient ones? Obviously, now I'm not talking about Western states at this point, but ethnographically known non-Western cases, perhaps, historically known cases that may directly inform some of the different cases that we're going to examine in this set of lectures in Mesopotamia or China or Mesoamerica or Africa, for example. Over the last century, theories of political development in archaeology have been dominated by evolutionary schema. I'm going to talk about this more during succeeding lectures. But what I want to note here is the varying levels of analogy between these cultural evolutionary schema in anthropology and archaeology and issues of biological evolution, understandings of biological evolution. One very influential view, developed by a variety of American anthropologists particularly and elaborated in the 1960s and 1970s, involved a succession of different political and social types over time in different parts of the world. And this succession moves from band to tribe to chiefdom to state. So let's talk about each of these in succession. The smallest scale of social and political organization in this kind of succession, in this theory of evolutionary succession of societies, would be the band. Band-level societies are usually associated with hunter-gatherer populations. They are small, often 40 to 50 people. These communities are mobile, and they're relatively egalitarian in terms of status. Modern populations might include, for example, the San people of Southern Africa, those people who are often called the Bushmen, Inuit or Eskimo populations in the Arctic, or Australian Aboriginal communities. These people are often the target of much ethnography through implicit or explicit assumptions that they are representatives of prehistoric forager populations, an incorrect assumption. Through time, then, political forms on larger scales evolved, leading first to tribes, the second unit in this succession. Tribes are usually agricultural communities. They're sedentary. They live in one place. They are groups of hundreds or perhaps thousands of people. But they're usually still egalitarian, broadly egalitarian, and there may be some form of coordinating community leadership. Modern cases involve many small-scale farming populations in different areas of the world. We have to note as well that in the media and often in general usage, we get some tendency to use the term tribal when the meaning is actually antique, traditional, old-fashioned, or backward. Again, a dangerous usage. The third unit in this succession, then, is the chiefdom. And this is one I want to come back to in a moment. Chiefdoms, though, are generally small-scale societies, but chiefdoms are characterized in part by the existence of some degree of inequality, of social and political hierarchy, often associated with this individual, a chief. They have elite and non-elite groups. As I say, I'll come back to chiefdoms. I'm going to be talking a lot about chiefdoms in this set of lectures. And then the fourth of these social political forms is the state. I've given some definitions of the state in an earlier lecture. Here we have this social political form with a centralized government, some form of bureaucracy, a redistribution system, and usually some degree of monopoly over the use of coercive force. It's often also associated with urbanism. States are associated with urbanism, with a market economy, with writing systems, and a variety of other characteristics that we will be looking at. So we have then this evolutionary sequence from bands to tribes to chiefdoms to states. Now, under this evolutionary model, archaeologists should probably search for and examine, note, chiefdoms, if they want to understand the origins of early states. Because it's the preceding socio-political form to the state. As I said, chiefdoms are usually described as societies with some degree of social ranking, hereditary inequality, chiefs with some degree of power over others, mostly agricultural societies. One issue that we're going to see repeatedly through these lectures, then, is that the classification of the chiefdom is often the, if you like, the default option for archaeologists looking at the origins of states in the past. And this is, again, a dangerous assumption. We can see, though, how it would work. If we have a fairly good definition of states, as I alluded to in my first lecture, and if we can tell when we do or do not have conditions for the state fulfilled, if we have societies that do or do not fulfill that definition of a state, then anything that looks doubtful will be called a chiefdom. We'll see this repeatedly through the course. Ethnographers have identified a large number of recent societies in different parts of the world as chiefdoms. Among the best known are, for example, Native American or First Nations communities along the western coast of North America, like the Nuchanult or Nootka, the Haida, or the Chumash people. Many of these societies, especially along the northwest coast, are highly unusual. They're sedentary, with people living in large permanent communities. And in pre-European times, they had quite rigid social hierarchies with nobility, commoners, and slaves. But these people were hunters and fishermen, and they did not practice agriculture. And as I said, this is extremely unusual. It's only rarely that we see it. But it existed because the products of the sea and the coastline along the northwestern coast of North America were so rich. Other communities, Hawaiian communities before European contact, along with those in other parts of Polynesia, are often designated as chiefdoms. In these areas, there's a complex balance between the spread of a common Polynesian culture between islands and different degrees of isolation and independent invention after that initial settlement. Native populations in the southeastern United States, like the Caddo, seem to have existed in chiefdoms in pre-European times. Unlike Northwest Coast Native American populations, these people were farmers, dependent especially on corn that had been adopted from Mesoamerica, probably in the first millennium AD. We'll come back to this issue of the domestication of corn in Mesoamerica in a later lecture. We can look at Southeast Asian chiefdoms, like the Shan and Naxi people of Yunnan in modern China into the 20th century. And in fact, we know of a variety of other recent cases of societies that we define as chiefdoms as well. Other cases are archaeologically known. The prehistoric Pueblo communities of the American Southwest are often identified as chiefdoms, although there's a good deal of argument about this. Bronze Age societies in Western Europe are usually identified as chiefdoms. Some late Mesolithic Scandinavian societies, especially communities like Ertebola, and probably some in coastal Peru and Ecuador, are identified as chiefdoms. Like those on the northwest coast, these latter societies are ones where marine resources probably played a huge role in providing the economic basis that allowed population growth and settlement stability. And one of the issues we're going to look at, especially, for example, in coastal Peru and Ecuador and Chile, one question is, what level of agriculture, what level of marine resources are necessary to support political developments toward the state? These and other chiefdom societies have varied widely in their size and in the elaboration of their political and social systems. Some are very small, with chiefs who only have a very precarious hold on power. For example, Sakur in Nigeria, close to where I work in northern Cameroon, where enforcement of the chief's rule is mostly by the family of the chief. So the chief had better hope that he has lots of sons and nephews. Lots of chiefs in Sakur were apparently murdered by rivals simply because their hold on power was so precarious. In other cases, chiefdoms are much larger and more hierarchical, and in some cases, they can hardly be distinguished from small states. For example, in Hawaii, at the time of European contact. Or perhaps some of the ancient Peruvian examples that we're going to look at with extraordinary monumental architecture, even in the third millennium BC. Reflecting this variability, then, chiefdoms are sometimes divided into two subtypes. First, archaeologists talk about simple chiefdoms, where kinship remains the primary determinant of social relations, and where only one level of chief exists. Sukkur, the case I mentioned, where there is a single chief who relies to a great extent on his family and his relatives to maintain his hold on power, is a good example of a simple chiefdom. On the other hand, we can talk about complex chiefdoms, which have a hierarchy of chiefs, and where the paramount chief, the ultimate chief, may wield considerable political and coercive power. This raises questions, though. Primary, very important question that I will be coming back to. Can we really use recent ethnographic and historical data where our knowledge most often comes from societies long after they began to interact with European and other states, and often in a context of warfare and colonialism? Can we really use such cases to understand the origins of the first states many millennia ago? The circumstances are, in these cases, extremely different. For those ancient states, almost by definition, there were no larger states affecting them originally. They grew up de novo, out of something quite different. The precariousness in the ruler, in the status of the ruler, was probably greater in those ancient states, in part because people had the option of leaving, of going someplace else. There's going to be all sorts of questions here. How did these societies evolve? How fast did these societies evolve? More than that, even more fundamentally, we have to ask ourselves, are these evolutionary models, band, tribe, chiefdom, state, for example, really good ways of thinking about the ancient world for archaeologists? Do they allow us to direct our attentions towards particular characteristics of ancient societies that really are central to political developments? Perhaps irrigation agriculture, for example, or warfare in circumscribed environments. Are these really central to political elements in general? Do these evolutionary models thus allow us, provide us a focus for archaeological research? Or do they potentially cause us to underestimate the diversity of ancient cultures, and thus perhaps ignore elements that aren't considered in these evolutionary models, but that might actually be vital to our understanding, our real understanding of ancient social and political changes over time? This is a real issue for archaeologists, and a great deal of debate exists over these evolutionary models. While these objections are important, I think they're really very significant. Many archaeologists, including myself, still think it's probably useful to examine recent or modern societies in order to gain some idea of what the origins of states might have looked like. This is not the only way we do it. This is not the only way we examine ancient states. But it gives us a sort of a repository, a reservoir of analogs that we can use to try and understand ancient cases. We have to remember, though, that these societies that we're using, these modern analogs that we're looking at, are themselves not ancient societies. They are modern. I'll address some of these issues in my next lecture. But here, for a moment, I'd like to illustrate the challenges that these issues can involve through work that I've done in the past in northern Cameroon. What I really want to demonstrate here, through a recent case, is the difficulties that researchers can face in identifying states, even when we have all kinds of ethnographic and historical data available that probably will not be directly available to archaeologists. So the case I want to just consider very briefly here is not an archaeological case, but it is rather historical research. And this is historical research on the origins of a state, a pre-colonial state in Central Africa called the Wandla State, which still exists in the area today in a kind of a attenuated or formal sense, and where we have abundant ethnographic and historical information. Now, Wandla is a small state existing on the margins of much larger and better known states like Kanem-Bornu and Bagirmi in Central Africa. It seems that the Wandla state only had very local influence in the region through the 17th and 18th centuries AD, but it reached its greatest extent between the 1780s and the 1820s, when it supposedly dominated much of the southern Lake Chad Basin, the area I work in. The eclipse of Wandla power came at the end of the 19th century when the state was incorporated within the German colony of Cameroon. Between the 1580s and 1900, historical sources inform us of the paths by which the Wandla progressively assumed the trappings of Sudanic statehood. And so this would theoretically, according to these evolutionary models then, be the development of a chiefdom into a state, and it is in fact described that way by researchers. This development supposedly involved a number of different processes. First, complex relations of tribute and conflict with the state of Kanem-Bornu from the 17th century onward. Second, conversion to Islam by the elite of the Wandla state in the early 18th century. Third, the centralization of administrative control and military power in the court of the Wandla state. And fourth, the development of a Wandla bureaucracy by the middle of the 19th century. The Wandla also borrowed the physical trappings of majesty in the Central Sudan. The ruler of the Wandla began living in a rectangular palace instead of the round compounds, households of common people. This rectangular architecture has been associated with elites and with governmental authority in this region actually until the middle of the 20th century. So living in a rectangular house is actually quite significant. Descriptions of the Wandla court by European travelers in the 19th century are similar to descriptions of their Kanem-Bornu and Bagirmian equivalents, from the dress and architecture associated with nobility to the ceremonial of the court, to the physical separation between the person of the ruler and those he ruled. One would expect such practices to legitimize Wandla's rulers. But the Wandla have always had something of an image problem. They were treated not as a separate state, but as vassals, as subjects by Kanem-Bornu, who maintained to Europeans that Wandla was simply one of their provinces. German travelers in the mid-19th century were contemptuous of courtly elaboration in such an insignificant place. And a British officer supplied perhaps the most devastating opinion of the Wandla, saying in 1916, "The ruler of Mandara," that is the Wandla, "the ruler of Mandara and the bulk of his people profess to be Mohammedans, Muslims, but their professions are little more than a veneer of respectability over their original paganism." That's pretty harsh. Part of the reason for this dismissal involved the close cultural resemblances and relationships between the Wandla and their non-Muslim mountain neighbors, those people who I primarily work among and where I'm doing archaeology now. These mountain populations live in what are usually designated as tribal societies by anthropologists. And they're thought of, or they were thought of, by Islamic and European elites as uncivilized savages. And they were so described by Wandla nobility as well. So this close relationship, this resemblance between a lot of the cultural practices of Wandla and their non-Muslim mountain neighbors was quite significant. By the 19th century, Islamic orthodoxy was an important characteristic of elite status in this part of the southern Lake Chad Basin, and the Wandla always had an odor of the backslider about them, not really good Muslims. But what would the Wandla state look like archaeologically? I'm an archaeologist. This is a question that I'm interested in. When I ask myself this question. What I look at is material culture, the actual distinctive artifacts and architecture and things that Wandala people make and that would be available for me as an archaeologist if I found them in the past. Wandala material culture is in many ways indistinguishable from the material culture of their non-Muslim mountain neighbors. Wandala households looked like those lived in by mountain people until the mid-20th century. From our archaeological excavations in the area, we know, for example, that most Wandala pottery has been more or less the same as that used by mountain people, even in the household of the ruler. Since pottery comprises the vast majority of artifacts recovered archaeologically from these regions, this is important. The same holds for iron tools, very similar to those of mountain people. As for the nobility and the court, silk robes will decay, precious items will be hoarded and redistributed, firearms and other weapons will be used to the breaking point and then the metal in them recycled. The courtly behaviors of the nobility, those will vanish entirely. Archaeologically, then, we cannot detect the most important social-political dichotomy of the late pre-colonial period in this region between Muslim Wandala and non-Muslim mountain people, although those two populations are supposed to sit decisively on different sides of the state-non-state divide, the Wandala state and mountain people living at a, quote, tribal, unquote, level. Does this simply mean that archaeology is limited in its ability to detect the existence of states? Now, this is always a challenge, it's true, but there's actually something more going on here, I'd argue. Maybe this consideration of material culture should lead us to think about the nature of the Wandala state. We could take, for example, as a starting point, the observation of a German traveler in 1875 that the Wandala army consisted of 1,000 men, of whom about 100 were cavalry, 20 or 30 were musketeers, and the rest were mountain levies armed with bows and arrows. This is not the striking arm of a powerful or even very unified Sudanic state. Once we look away from elite historical accounts and the Wandala palace, the Wandala state begins to dissolve. Local centers, even 12 kilometers, 8 miles from the capital, retained sufficient independence to deny entry to the theoretical Wandala rulers throughout their history, right up until the 20th century. The inner field of empire in Wandala, to use American anthropologist Stephen Reyna's evocative term for the area directly controlled by the rulers of a state, seems to be about 10 kilometers, 6 miles wide. And I'll be talking about Reyna's work on the partitioning of state territories in a later lecture. Stateliness in Wandala seems to be the product of two separate political traditions. One is indigenous, existing over long periods, but this model depends on relations between leaders and local spirits of the land who control the sources of spiritual power for a community and who must be propitiated personally. This model doesn't generate political units more than a few kilometers wide, and thus is really too small to be of significance for the territory of a state. The second model is Islamic, centered in the court and associated with elite resource extraction via slave raiding in this area and elite display. These two models exist simultaneously in Wandala, but they do not interact a great deal. The latter system, the Islamic model of court display, is the one that has been presented by the Wandala elite to the outside world, but it seems to have little to do with what we would call government. It seems to be rather a mechanism for support of the court. That court has used elite material culture to appropriate the form of stateliness, in Islamic terms, but little of its substance from other more established states. It's almost as if that old French term, l'état c'est moi, or perhaps in this case, l'état c'est nous, we are the state, as proclaimed by the nobility, is a real description of how the Wandala state works. The state is the court and nothing else. Louis XIV would have been proud. As a final assessment, Wandala really doesn't fit comfortably at any point on these conventional typologies of band, tribe, chiefdom, state. It's more than a chiefdom. It might be conceived of as a state and has so been accepted by a lot of Western anthropologists, but it could also be thought of as, first, a con job foisted upon credulous outsiders, or, second, a free-floating court sustained by slave raiding but with no major role in governance of territory. Question rather depends on who asks it and who answers. I hope that this illustrates some of the complexity of analyzing states, even in quite recent periods. These models are sometimes useful simplifications when we're thinking about how the world really works, but we should not mistake such models for reality. In the next lecture, we'll further consider some of these models that have been proposed in the analysis of ancient state formation. Thank you.